Hi, and welcome back to CavalierCast, the Civil War in Words. Thanks for staying tuned to the podcast, despite the long interval from the last episode. It's so great to be recording again. Although there's not been fresh episodes for a little while, it's really encouraging that the episodes have continually been downloaded. I appreciate all of the kind messages of support for the podcast and your patience. This is a wholly independent work that I produce. I do hope you're all keeping well. Where have I been, you might ask? Well, over the last year, I've been researching and writing a biography of King Charles I, which is due out this year. It's been a fabulous journey. Now, just to recap on CavalierCast's purpose, it's a podcast that explores anything and everything to do with the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, a much overlooked period of our history. In episode 18, we're going to explore one of the most infamous of Civil War sieges, that of Lathom House in the northwest of England. I'll be speaking to two experts. Firstly, Jennifer Cooley Draskow, who is a senior research fellow with the University of Liverpool. She recently wrote a book about Charlotte, Countess of Derby, the title of which replicates the name Lady Derby's enemies gave her, the Great Whore of Babylon. Now, Lathom House was owned by the Earl and Countess who garrisoned it for King Charles I's royalist cause during the Civil War. Lady Derby successfully led the first siege in 1644, and after the relief of the house, she retired to the Isle of Man. Following King Charles I's execution in 1649, Lord Derby fought for the late king's son, the future Charles II, leaving Lady Derby in charge of the Isle of Man. Lord Derby's support for the young Charles would lead to his own execution in 1651. My second guest is Warwick Luth, a conflict and battlefield archaeologist, and I'm pleased to say that Warwick will be joining me on CavalierCast as our regular expert in this field. Now, we'll mull over Lathom House and what's left today, as well as some of the finds from the site. So without further ado, let's begin episode 18. So welcome to CavalierCast, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to speak to you today.
Hi, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So, Jennifer, you've written a book about Ilium Dawn, who was the chief civil servant on the Isle of Man during the lifetime of the Earl and Countess of Derby in the 17th century. And you're a descendant of Ilium. And you've now written this book about the Countess of Derby. So can you tell us why you feel that Lady Derby has been maligned?
She was very staunchly Protestant, both politically and religiously.
Yeah.
And she has been represented right from Scott, from Sir Walter Scott, as a raving sort of papist person, which is the last thing she was. And so that's a misrepresentation for a start. She's also misrepresented as having sought vengeance on Ilium Dawn, blaming him for her husband's execution, which is ridiculous. It's a fiction. She knew that he had enemies. His enemies were not Ilium Dawn. Ilium Dawn was faithful to him all the time.
And who do you consider Lord Derby's enemies to have been?
That his enemies were called Bradshaw, Rigby and Birch, and they had it in for him, and they also had a hand in his execution. But Lady Derby was a realist, if nothing else, and she knew that it didn't lie within her power to exact vengeance on them. So while she confided to her sister-in-law, because a lot of the work that I've done reposes upon the letters that she exchanged with her sister-in-law, her brother's wife, and she said, you know, if I could get my own back on Bradshaw, Rigby and Birch, but I know it's not possible. I can't do that. I haven't got the power to do it. And she never mentions Ilium Dawn. Bradshaw, Rigby and Birch were various people who'd crossed Lord Derby in the past and who bore him ill will. And right. So they were keen on his execution and really connived at it. And of course it was ordered by Cromwell. So it was nothing to do with Ilium Dawn. It could never have been anything to do with Ilium Dawn. He didn't have that kind of power in England. He had power in the Isle of Man, but not in England. He could never have organised something like that.
In a previous episode, when I talked to Leander Delisle about Henrietta Maria and her image, in a little bit of a similar way to this, is it because she was a woman who was portrayed as wearing the breeches? I mean, Lady Derby really conducted a courageous defence of Leatham House, didn't she? And probably upset
a lot of... Well, she only wore the breeches. Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I think that that is perfectly true, what dear Leander says about Henrietta Maria, and many people complained of it. In the case of Lady Derby, I would deny it, because I think she only stepped into what we might describe as a breeches role when she had to defend her house and her husband's house. And then she did. She did it like a military commander. But the rest of the time, she didn't. She stepped up to the plate and she said, you are not having my husband's house. You're not persuading us and you're not having our property. And that's it. So, you know, over my dead body. So I wouldn't necessarily say that that applied in the same measure to Lady Derby, because the rest of her life, she doesn't seem to have been so influential in his decisions.
Lady Derby did incur a bit of puritanical wrath, you know, for that defence. I mean, it was a bit of a thorn in Rigby's side, wasn't it, and Parliament's side?
Oh, she certainly did. Well, this is why they called her what they called her, you know, which they did call her that. She was reviled by her enemies as the wicked woman or the great whore of Babylon. And a preacher took as his text, just before the first siege of Latham, Jeremiah 50, which he was bringing the faithful to place themselves in array against Babylon round about. All ye that bend the bow, shoot at her, spare no arrows, for she hath sinned against the Lord. This was religious and political. But when they wanted to revile female protagonists, it was always a question of sleaze. You know, she's no better than she ought to be, that sort of thing. That was their point of attack. And actually, I mean, she, for heaven's sake, she was a mother of seven. I don't think she was particularly, I don't think she was by nature either a particularly warlike person or a particularly lustful person. But very often these religious slurs took the form of that kind of sleaze. And I can remember that in Liverpool for many, many years, the Church of Rome, Roman Catholicism, was known as the Scarlet Woman of the Seven Hills. The folk rock group Steel Eye Span produced an album, you know, which the whole thing is called, they called her Babylon. And in the title track, they devoted to the siege of Latham and to Charlotte's successful defence. And they don't get many things wrong. And I think Maddie Pryor said that they started out wanting it just to be an account. But they afterwards, they were so in awe of Lady Derby's achievements that it became more like a paean to her success. So that was quite interesting.
But you mentioned earlier Sir Walter Scott had written about her and described her as a papist as well. So her reputation and her renown have cropped up, you know, many times since the Civil War. So could you tell me a little bit more about how that's affected her image?
Well, only insofar as... a lot of people read Scott. I mean, he was the J.K. Rowling or the James Patterson of his time, wasn't he? And people did read him. And they viewed her and continued to view her as a hysterical French aristocrat who was a papist. And she wasn't. You wanted to know, I think, about her descent and who she was descended from. Well, on the French side, her father's side, she was descended from an ancient... line of Burgundian French aristocrats, and some of them were crusaders, some of them were regarded as saints, some of them were princes, some of them were tyrants, and a lot of them were murderers, both male and female.
Right.
They were enmeshed in internecine struggles, and they were steeped in blood. And on the other hand, her mother, Charlotte Brabantina of Orange, was the fifth of the six orphan daughters of William the Silent of Orange, father and liberator of the Netherlands, who led the Dutch revolt against Catholic Spain, a very strong Protestant, and he was assassinated in his own home at Delft by a Catholic zealot. Her brother converted to Protestantism, And she was brought up a Protestant by her mother, and occasionally she spent time at the court in The Hague, the court of her grandfather. And she was brought up particularly because her mother, it was a lot of sad story. I mean, people were always trying. Some of them were in the pay of Spain. I don't know how many of them were, but they were always having a go at William of Orange because he wanted to get the Netherlands provinces free, the Dutch provinces free from the yoke of Spain. And his third wife was Charlotte's grandmother, another Charlotte. She was Charlotte de Bourbon-Montpensier, who had escaped a convent. She revoked her Catholicism and became a Protestant and escaped over the convent walls and married William of Orange as his third wife. And she produced him six daughters in 7 years, the second youngest of whom was Charlotte's mother. And he was attacked when Charlotte was very little. And Charlotte's grandmother wore herself out trying to look after him, and she died. And so William of Orange married again, and he married a French woman this time called Louise de Coligny, a very strong Protestant whose father and previous husband, had been murdered in the Bartholomew's Day riots. So Louise was a very strong Protestant, and she became Charlotte de la Tremouille's step-grandmother and was very influential. She was very influential in bringing up Charlotte Brabantina, Charlotte's mother. You know, Protestantism could not have been more strongly ingrained in her. I mean, her family had paid for it in blood. I'm not friendly with Scott about his book, Peveril, as those who attended the launch of my own book on Lady Derby will be aware, because to me, his portrayal of Lady Derby as a scheming, screaming French Catholic hag, and also his portrayal of one of the greatest Manxmen of all time, and I don't mean Ilium Dohn, I mean his relation, Edward Christian, is absolutely villainous. And for once, the Christian family did contact Scott and complain to him. And he said, oh, he's a figment of the imagination. Well, the funny thing is, he used elements of the real Edward Christian's careers in his fiction, and he said, oh, it's all fiction, darling. Nobody pays attention to it. He was actually very naughty. And he said, oh, and Lady Derby, I know she wasn't really a papist, but, you know, it suited the story. It's fiction, darling. Nobody cares.
I mean, that's outrageous, isn't it?
He said that. Yeah, he wrote back to the Christians and he said, well, no, but it's fiction, darling. You know, I made it all up. Well, no, you didn't, actually, because these were real people. And I kind of object to that, you know? Yeah,
you know,
and you know they have descendants and things, and it's kind of important. The only thing where I would say that Lady Derby got across Ilium Dohn was that when the island was left in their joint charge, they gave each other an agreement, apparently, that neither would negotiate with the Roundheads without the knowledge of the other.
Right.
So Lady Derby then learned two things, because they had spies everywhere and fishermen and people coming and going and people who'd run away. You know, they had people with information. And she learned, firstly, that Lord Derby had been taken prisoner after the unsuccessful battle of Wigan Lane and was in captivity with the Roundheads. And secondly, that Colonel Duckenfeld had been dispatched by Cromwell to reduce the Isle of Man, and he was sheltering in Beaumaris with a large fleet on his way to the Isle of Man. He was sheltering from the tempestuous October gales in the Irish Sea, which anybody can appreciate. And she sent to Colonel Duckenfield, and she didn't tell Ilium Dohn, and she said, if you can procure the release of my husband, I will give you the Isle of Man.
Ah, right.
And when Ilium found out, because they all had their spies, and he found out, that was the start of the rising. And he went to his house at Ronaldsway, and he summoned 800 Manxmen, we're told, and he said, the old earl was good enough, but she will sell you for tuppence or threepence a head. What do you say? And that was the rising.
Yeah, so I can so, completely...
I mean, you can understand her motives. We understand
yes,
her motives
yeah.
perfectly well. Mm. It was her husband, and I think she loved him, you know, as far as these arranged marriages went. I think they were compatible. He certainly spoke very, very praisingly of her always. You know, saying how what a wonderful, worthwhile person she was,
yeah,
and how much he cared for her. He certainly, all his papers testify to that. And she seems to have been fond of him. So you can understand her motives, but from William Doane's point of view, that wasn't going to happen because he was a Manx patriot, and it wasn't going to happen.
I think we've touched on the illustrious ancestry of Lady Derby there. Just to recap on that link with William the Silent, Prince of Orange. So that was Charlotte's grandfather.
Her grandfather.
Yeah. And also she was described in her lifetime as one of the three most important women in Britain, wasn't she?
She was described by the Roundheads, her enemies, as the three women who ruined the kingdom. Three women who ruined the kingdom were Eve, the wife of Adam, who let sin into the Garden of Eden.
Right.
With the serpent and the apple and the whole bit, you know. Mm-hmm. Henrietta Maria, the wife of Charles I, who was considered as meddlesome, as manipulative, as lightweight, but bossy, and was also a papist. And the English didn't like papists by that stage. And the third was Lady Derby, who resisted the Roundheads and defended her house, lay them against them.
So it was the parliamentarians who said that she was one of the three ladies who ruined Britain.
The three women who ruined the kingdom. And you can see that in, I think, Antonia Fraser, in her book on 17th century women, quotes that.
Excellent. So, and you've read the Countess's correspondence, you said, to get a feel for her family, her life and her time. So what would you say was the biggest revelation that you came across?
Biggest revelation? Well, I think she was very pragmatic and also very brave. I think if you and I had been responsible for holding off for 4 months a huge parliamentary force, I think we'd boast a bit, or we'd lie on our laurels or do something. She never did. She never dwelt on her military achievements. It's as if she said, right, well, that was then. I did what needed to be done, and I did it, and that's over. And now I'm going to move on and do other things.
Yeah.
She did what she perceived to be her duty in challenging circumstances. She was steadfast. She saw it through. And I think she would have embraced martyrdom. Not in a hysterical way, but if it came, she'd have done it, you know? But afterwards, she never dwelt on it. And that was one thing that interested me. And also, I think she was very capable of turning from that really quite unusual for a woman military role. She went round inspecting the cannon, and she kept the enemy hanging on for about 8 months while she negotiated, and in the meantime she smuggled men and arms and supplies into Latham, and that's why Latham could withstand the siege. But afterwards she went back to court, to the court of Charles II, and became what she'd always been, the consummate French courtier. She was interested in, you know, questions of precedence and questions of marriage and court gossip and that kind of thing. And she went back to that kind of thing apparently quite easily.
And what do her letters tell us about her character and family life? I mean, we've probably touched on this a little bit.
I think she was probably she was quite a tough bird. And she had trouble with her eldest son all her life. And so did Lord Derby. He did various things that she just couldn't forgive. And the major one was that if you were an aristocrat, you could hold all sorts of things and enjoy many favours. But when the king needed you, you had to produce arms and equipment and soldiers, and you had to go and fight for the king. That's what you did. And he didn't do that. I mean, his father was there fighting, and Lord Derby was not really a natural warrior. I don't think he made a lot of mistakes. He went because he had to go. But the son, Charles, just went off to Holland and France and hung about there and married somebody that they didn't approve of and tried to do deals with the Parliament. And really, at one point, Lord Derby was so fed up with Charles that he applied to the king and said, I wish to disinherit my eldest son. I don't want him to inherit anything after me because I'm not satisfied with his behavior.
Right.
So
okay, so
all her life, she had trouble with Charles, her oldest son. I think she was concerned for her daughters, and she took a great deal of interest after the Civil War had ended. Firstly, in finding suitable jobs for her younger sons, William and Edward, and also in arranging suitable marriages and alliances for her three daughters. And that was really, and she, after the war, you have to realize that they'd lost a lot of their property. Mm. And so comparatively, she was impoverished. And it was very important that her girls should marry well. It was very important that the boys should have some kind of useful employment. And she devoted her time to that. She was also very religious, so she spent a lot of time praying and thanking God, you know, for the restoration of the king, etc. But that was mainly what she occupied her time with. And she didn't have enough, she wasn't able to flash the cash like she had been earlier.
After the Civil War ends, the parliamentarians and the victors, she's not going to find much comfort at that point, especially with what's been said of her. She needs to make the best of it for her and her family.
She had to make the best of it, absolutely.
And so you mentioned there, so that was Charles, her eldest son. During the Civil War, even when his father's fighting for the king, he's around in Holland, you know, keeping out of the fray, even in contact with his father's enemies. Yeah, and to hear that Lord Derby even tried to disinherit.
They were reconciled when Lord Derby was under sentence of execution. And Charles, he rode to London to beg for a reprieve and didn't get it. And he did go back to Bolton, where Lord Derby was to be executed, and stayed with him while he sort of prayed and got dressed for the execution and did whatever. And Lord Derby wrote to Lady Derby and said, I think you better forgive our son because, you know, these last few days he's really been a good support and, you know, he's not all bad sort of thing. But she didn't forgive him. But he said, I think you should forgive him now because, you know, it's all sort of over.
There's been comments about Lady Derby's pompous nature, perhaps, and the way that she was intolerant of anybody that she saw as being beneath her. But did you find any evidence of that?
Not really. I mean, I think she was no... Let me see, when I think about this, I thought she was what you could expect, really, in somebody of her status in an age that was not democratic. You know, it was that kind of age where aristocrats could be fairly high-handed and were fairly high-handed. And I don't think she was unduly so. I'm sure she probably didn't suffer fools. But if you look at her status in life, I wouldn't say that she was... I have no personal experience of her being pompous because most of her correspondence is with people of similar status to herself, like, for example, her first cousin and sister-in-law. And there she seems to bare her soul. And she praises quite a lot of people, clerics and other people, you know, who have helped her. I remember one of the things that Lady Derby said was, and now that my son has become the Lord of Man, he has reinstituted the ceremony of having the sword of state carried in front of him, which is something my husband never did. A more modest man, I think.
So if we move on to Lathom House and the siege, I mean, the scale of the house, I mean, you're talking about 25-foot moat, double-ringed walls, nine towers, each had cannon. You've got gamekeepers, snipers in the towers. And in the centre of that, you've got Lady Derby with 300 soldiers. So when it was besieged in 1644, Lord Derby wrote to Fairfax and said, you know, let my wife and children out. Please let them come to safety.
Fairfax agreed, but Lady Derby didn't. You know, she said, I'm not going to leave this house while they are besieging it. So how instrumental do you think she was in preventing the parliamentarians from taking that house?
Oh, I think she was utterly... the value of her leadership is undoubted. For one thing, she, as I mentioned before, kept the parliamentarians dangling in negotiations for months. And during that time, she smuggled in supplies and a garrison until it was 300 men strong, which was quite a lot. And she also had her cannon. Some of the towers and the ramparts already housed pieces of ordnance and what they called murderers, which were big blunderbusses mounted on pivots. And during the uneasy months of detente, reinforcement supplies and gunpowder were secretly brought in. And eventually she had a garrison numbering 300 men, and she had snipers in all the towers. And the proof of the value of her leadership is that after the first siege, when she did finally leave for the Isle of Man, Latham fell to the enemy quite easily, and it was razed to the ground. There's nothing left. Right. If you want proof, that's the proof, isn't it?
Yeah.
She did it. She saved it. There's no doubt about it.
Definitely.
And she used to go. Well, she used to walk around, and you know, she'd go to the chapel and have a pray, and then she was with Samuel Rutter, who was her chaplain, and then she'd have a wander around the ramparts and have a look at the pieces of ordnance and talk to the captains about it. You know, she took a very active interest.
And that there's a time as well when she was, I think she was either at a meal or she was getting dressed, and a cannon shot came into the room.
They say she was at table when with her dinner when a mortar shell exploded in the dining room, and she went on eating, and in the end she had to be persuaded to move to a less vulnerable part of the house. You know, but she wasn't for moving. She's really tough. You asked also about how active she was in the defence of the island. There isn't much record of that. I think after she left for Man, she went back to the normal duties, which was the running of a huge household. And the defence of the island was really in the hands of her husband. And he took it very seriously, going around and fortifying things and organising a navy and doing stuff, you know.
Oh, I see. Okay,
but I don't think she did much there. I think she you know, she'd done Latham, she'd shot her boat, that was it.
That, just to recap then for listeners, so Latham House successfully fends off the parliamentarians. We have the Battle of Marston Moor on the 2nd of July 1644. Royalists lose that battle and the parliamentarians come back to Latham, in which time Lady Derby's gone to the Isle of Man to join Lord Derby. And that's, as you see, when the house fell relatively easily to the parliamentarians. I think probably as well, a response that she made to Sir Thomas Fairfax when he was asked her to surrender Latham was probably indicative of how she might be branded pompous, saying notwithstanding her recent condition, she remembered both her lord's honour and her own birth, conceiving it more knightly that Sir Thomas Fairfax should wait upon her rather than she upon him.
But it's a game, isn't it? I mean, by saying that, she prolongs the negotiations, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what she wanted to do. If she capitulated at any time, she wouldn't have had the chance that she did, that she took and exploited to get people in and to get all the stuff in that she needed in order to withstand a siege. And it's part of the game. It's the dance. And Lord Derby himself sent all sorts of wonderful responses when he was told to surrender the Isle of Man. And he said, should you approach me again or something like that, I shall have no compunction in burning your message and hanging the bearer. And this is the last word of him who accounts himself richest to be the servant of his majesty, or something like that. And something like, I mean, that's pretty pompous too. But that's the way negotiations were conducted.
So, yeah, absolutely. Gives her a bit more time. And then obviously that time, I mean, you mentioned the mortar as well earlier. So that when the mortar did arrive, Fairfax had left the siege by then, and it was in Colonel Rigby's command.
Yes, indeed.
he actually sent a warning in saying, you know, surrender now, otherwise I'll unleash the mortar. And again, you know, talking about the responses and the buying time. So Lady Derby had said, go back to your commander and tell that insolent rebel he shall have neither sons, goods, nor house. When our strength is spent, we shall find a fire more merciful than Rigby's. And then, if providence of God prevent it not, my goods and house shall burn in his sight, myself, my children, and my soldiers, rather than fall into his hands. We'll seal our religion and loyalty in the same flames. Strong stuff. And as you say, you know, she was willing to go down with that house, wasn't she?
She would, yes, I think so.
Did she come close to being killed during the siege any other times apart from the mortar?
Not that I know of, and she certainly doesn't say to her, she doesn't write an awful lot during the Siege of Leith. I mean, you do understand it. I mean, she picks up her correspondence with her sister-in-law later, but she doesn't really ever say how terrified they were. The only thing she does say is that her daughters, her little girls, were with her, and how courageous they had been and what fortitude they had shown. She comments on that. And so on. And then, of course, they were kidnapped and taken prisoner and kept hostages in Liverpool. And she was very concerned for them, particularly for Amelia, the future Duchess of Athol, because she said Amelia's not very strong and she's easily frightened. And I don't know this Birch, I don't know what he's going to do.
Ah, right. Okay. And was this after she surrendered?
It was after
the Isle of Man. Right.
Yeah. Well, that was while they were in the Isle of Man. After she had left Latham, and Latham had not yet been recapped. I'm not sure when it was, but it was when she was in the Isle of Man that they sent Catherine and Amelia to Knowsley to try and keep Knowsley for the family by force of occupation. And they were kidnapped and taken off to Liverpool and kept in what she described as insalubrious surroundings by Birch, who was the governor of Liverpool. And she was very concerned for them. And that was to make Lord Derby, again, that was pressure on him, to make him surrender the Isle of Man. So they kept his daughters as hostages. I mean, they did some horrid things to them. And she was very concerned about that.
And how did Lady Derby fare come the restoration of the monarchy with Charles II in 1660?
Well, she was impoverished because many of the Derby estates had been sequestered or they'd been given to other people or sold to other people. And she didn't get on with her son. And so she didn't receive, she should have had a dower revenue from the Isle of Man, but she never received that. And she wrote to her sister, "Well, my friends say that I ought to tell my son to jolly well get on with it and give me the money from the Isle of Man that is my dower revenue." But she said, because of his character, and I don't like his wife, that Jezebel, she said, so I'm not going to even ask him. I'm not even going to bother. So she didn't. So she didn't have much money. And King Charles II received her kindly, because, of course, he was conscious that the Earl of Derby had actually died for the royalist cause. And he promised her the post of governess to his children. But tragically for him and tragically for her, he had no legitimate children. I mean, I'm sure he had lots of illegitimate children, but he didn't have any legitimate children. And so she never became the governess to them. And so she spent her time gathering up what money she could, trying to arrange marriages for her daughters and obtaining suitable posts for the boys.
Well, that's been really fascinating. Thank you very much. I've learned so much about Lady Derby and especially that Charles II had agreed to make her governess to his children. Never knew that as well.
Yes, and she lived on that hope, you see, because that would have been great.
Yeah.
She'd have been at court and she'd have had a status and things, you know, and she lived on in hopes of that. But of course, he and Queen Catherine weren't able to conceive and so the children weren't born. It is really, she got her daughters married off and she got her sons in positions. But I think it was quite sad after the sort of glory that she'd had before. But there you are, that's life, isn't it? You know,
really fascinating. Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
It's been lovely to talk to you and thank you very much.
So we've heard from Jennifer about Lady Derby and the siege of Leatham House was touched upon as the scene, perhaps, of the action that made her name echo down the centuries. So we're going to investigate a little bit more about the siege of Leatham, as well as find out what is left today and bring that story right up to date. So new to Cavalier Cast, I'm really excited to chat about this with Warwick Luth, military historian, qualified conflict and battlefield archaeologist. And Warwick is going to be a regular addition to Cavalier Cast as our resident expert in such matters. So Warwick, welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Good evening. Nice to see you, Mark.
So let's talk about you for a moment, Warwick. So help listeners get to know you. So you grew up near another infamous Civil War siege site, didn't you? Basing House.
I did indeed, yes. The Basing, I was visiting Basing, you know, from about the age of seven. I had family, you know, that believed, you know, if you want to, you know, educate your children, okay, you take them to the sites. Basing, you know, was right on our doorstep. And if you want to, you know, look for dramatic adventure stories, look at the history of the siege. It's right there for you. And in that part of Hampshire, you go to every other village, every other town, it's got a story to tell. It's part of the reason, you know, obviously I work as a military historian. It's why I specialize in the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, because you go throughout Britain, everywhere has a story to tell about it. So yes, Basing, you know, is fundamental in how I got here today, basically.
Yeah, like everything, it's that what is the spark, isn't it? But you've got so many to choose from there, so many sites in that immediate vicinity.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, everywhere you've got Farnham up the road. Farnham, I was working in the museum just after leaving school and working for their small fines. And, you know, they put a box of musket balls on my table and basically said, you can have a look through there. There's not much you can tell from a musket ball. And then, you know, immediately, you know, even at that young age, you know, I thought, you know, shock, horror, you know, this is, you know, finds from, you know, such a dramatic event, you know, it's pivotal to our nation's history. And, you know, it stayed in my mind, you know, going on into my further studies at university, you know, looking at how musket balls can be used, you know, it's
yeah,
you know, although it's a tiny thing, you know, unpack what it can show you. Okay. It's massive.
Yeah, that's it. And exactly what you say there, you know, it's just having the being brought face to face with it all and being able to touch it, feel it. And I think that's why the whole reenactment scene is so crucial, isn't it, to history?
Absolutely. It is that ephemeral, you know, being able to touch it, being able to see it, being able to see how life was lived and how these things were used, okay, is so important. You can go into a classroom. You can read a book. Okay, it's not the same as seeing it being done for real. Seeing is half the learning job done. You know, and if reenactors can be praised for anything, you know, students, young children, okay, who might not have an interest in history, it ignites that spark. It's why the reenactment community continues to go from strength to strength, because yeah, you know, people who might not, you know, go down the academic history route, it gives them a way of contributing and learning from it at the same time as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point, you know, isn't it? It's another side to an academic book, a novel or something like that. You know, this is actually being there, smelling it, being in amongst it. And you don't necessarily need any prior knowledge of it, do you? You know, you can go along to these and get drawn straight in.
Absolutely. I mean, I work at a museum up here in Scotland that does have an arms and armor handling part to it. And you can have a group of 16-year-olds and getting anything out of them, you know, during a school session, it's like getting blood out of stone. But you hand them a sword, you hand them a set of armor, and they immediately come to life.
Yeah, definitely. And your dad as well was in reenactment, wasn't he? So he was in Appleyard's Yeomanry of Foot, you mentioned.
That's correct, yeah. Many, many moons ago, Appleyard's, for those of you that don't know, was one of the Irish regiments. That was in Hopton's army. It actually got destroyed very early on at the Battle of Cheriton in March 1644, being pushed out of the woods by the London trained bands. The present regiment, I believe, has now been subsumed into Rawdon's regiment in the Sealed Knot. But he spent a couple of years serving as a pikeman in that regiment. He actually took part in the filming of the By the Sword Divided for the BBC up at Buckingham Castle. There's a scene in one of the later programmes in the first series where they're digging out some earthworks, and a cannonball comes in and, you know, blows them all to sundry, and you can pick out, you know, on the scene exactly where he is and who he is. So
excellent. I mean, he did have a real near miss as well, didn't he, at Rockingham?
He did. Another battle, another event at Rockingham. He was in the middle of a pike block, and the pike block, you know, is thick in the push. And it wandered in front of the gun line just as it went off. And the pike block was sent, you know, left, right, and centre. Picked himself up, you know, with flash wounds all over his face, you know, and then people, wow, you know, flames coming off their jackets, you know, patting them out and rolling over and ducking and thing. So I think that was his swan song in terms of reenactment. But yes, no, he came very, very close there. He still has tinnitus in his ears from that. So, yeah.
All right, yeah, so he's got a lifelong souvenir of that.
Absolutely.
Wow, okay, thanks, Warwick. So tell us a bit about Leatham. So the house was quite a structure, wasn't it?
It's a big house. It's one of the finest houses in Northern England. There's one person who describes it, you know, like a town in itself. If we look at the kind of the makeup of the building, you know, it's got 18 towers. It's got two curtain walls. It's got a deep moat around it. You know, it's 8 yards deep by 2 yards wide. So it's a big, big structure. It's got a drawbridge. It's got a strong gate. The Eagle Tower, you know, that everyone mentions about Leatham, you know, is built in the same manner as you know, James of St. John at Carnarvon. So certainly the family, the Derby family, the Stanleys, you know, they've got delusions of grandeur. They want to be seen as, you know, being in the same league as somewhere like Carnarvon Castle. So it is a huge structure. And the fact that the first siege, you know, lasts, you know, 3 months, you know, from February to May 1644, for a Civil War siege, that's quite a big time period. So yes, it's an enormous structure.
I mean, say about their delusions of grandeur as well, but on top of that, it mustn't have helped being known as the ruler of man either.
Doesn't help either. Doesn't help, you know, it's like, you know, painting a big old, you know, red flag for a bull. You know, everyone's going to come for you if you try and do that.
And that's the Isle of Man, by the way, as well there. So he was also Lord of Man. Yeah, so a huge, I mean, I can just picture Lady Derby at the top of that Eagle Tower, you know, just overlooking, you know, what's going
absolutely
on.
Absolutely, I always have an image of her being quite a haughty person as well. Not someone to get on the wrong side of, you know, she's definitely formidable.
And Jennifer had mentioned as well, you know, for all she was described as a Catholic, during that siege, the first siege, she had a Protestant rector holed up in the garrison as well for the siege. You know, she wasn't a Catholic, even though she was billed as one by her enemies.
I mean, yes, I mean, this is a common theme as well of you know, a number of the sieges during the Civil War. And a number of the people who are serving, you know, with the Royalists as well. You know, there are lots and lots of closet Catholics who have, as parts of their household, Protestant rectors, you know, Protestant manservants. Really, you know, since the Reformation, you know, it's not illegal necessarily to practice Catholicism. It is illegal to try and bring Catholics into the fold, though. And if you're going to get by, you know, as a Catholic in England, okay, you know, you've got to keep a low profile. So certainly, you know, mixing of Catholics and Protestants, despite the popular perception of the Civil War, you know, as this being this big religious divide, they lived quite freely amongst each other, and certainly within the Royalist forces, you know, Catholics are quite prevalent. They're certainly not absent from the scene.
Yeah, and as you said there, so first siege lasts around 3 months. At the end of that, when Prince Rupert relieves the place, he doesn't actually relieve it, does he? So I think the besiegers leave because they hear of his approach.
Exactly. I mean, the fact is that Rupert's in the area. Okay, if he's in the area, okay, he's going to funnel more troops in there anyway. They don't want to get into prolonged fights in the siege lines with him. So it's better just to go away, okay? Wait their time. He's going to go away at some point, and then at that point, reinvest the house as well. It's not worth fighting it on the doorstep to leave them fight and run away and fight another day, basically.
Yeah. So the siege is lifted. I think Lady Derby returns to the Isle of Man. Parliament, obviously, after the second siege, eventually capture the house. So that siege is July to December 45.
That's right. Isn't it?
Now, I believe that included a mutiny. What brought it
Absolutely.
Down?
I mean, the garrison, they can see the writing is on the wall. And so they're basically making treaties to Lady Derby, basically saying, look, if we hold out any longer, okay, all hell is going to break loose. So.
And as soon as the house is captured, it's dealt with pretty swiftly, isn't it? I mean, it's demolished.
I mean, demolished is a light word for it. Okay, in terms of the scale of the slicing and destruction of the house, it's big. We know for a fact, okay, they tear down most of the buildings. The fabric of the buildings is largely robbed out, so all the lead's taken off the roofs. If it's not being taken and being remelted down as musket shot by the Parliamentarian army, then it's being taken away by the inhabitants of Wigan for other use as well. Certainly the fabric of the building is robbed out. And if you go to buildings surrounding Laverham, dating to a similar period, a lot of the fabric of the building, if it has not just been ruined on the site, has been incorporated into those buildings as well. We know for a fact that in the 1670s on the site, there's 3 timber buildings roughly underneath where the west transept of the later house would have sat. But we know that by the time of the 18th century, when they're putting in the Palladian manor that goes on the site afterwards, they completely and utterly demolish that. All the ruins are put into basically a robber trench covered over. And that's the last of the house as it would have been at the time of the Civil War. It's completely subsumed either into the fabric of the later house or just destroyed. I think it's also the fact that it is destroyed so completely might well indicate the level of damage done to the house post-Civil War as well. The fact that it is almost entirely torn down except for 3 buildings suggests that it is in such a bad state, okay, it's not worth keeping as an inhabitation, okay, for the Stanley family. So that may well be a case in point as well.
And it seems to have been demolished prior to the start of 1647.
Yes.
So is there anything left of this at all today? So you said there was any sort of site of earthworks or moats?
So in terms of earthworks, there is absolutely tons. We know for a fact that during the siege, parliamentarians, they put in lines of circumvallation around the house, lines to which they can gradually move their guns closer to the walls to undercut them, basically. And these are dug out from about 60, 100 and 200 yards from the walls. Now, if you go onto the site today, okay, they're not going to be very well sighted. You won't be able to see them very, very clearly. But what we can do is something called LIDAR. Now, LIDAR, okay, is basically you take a helicopter, you fly it across the site, and it's got a light-emitting diode, okay, that bounces laser beams from the aircraft down onto the ground. That's then fed back to a receiver in the aircraft, okay? It's measuring the time between the signal being emitted to how long it's coming back. That creates a set of algorithms that's then fed into a wireframe model, and we can look at subtle variations in the ground position according to these earthworks. Now, it's very, very good because, of course, you've got the Lavram Park around it. Large amounts of these earthworks, modern woodlands has overgrown it. So we can remove all of that entirely, and we can get a tabletop view, okay, of what these earthworks would have looked like. So we've got lines of circumvallation. You've also got revetments directly in front of the walls. So if they get hit by a cannon shot, they're not going to immediately cave in as well. And these are at least 2 yards thick. There is evidence as well. There is an earthwork to the southeast of the house, about 900 meters out, called Cromwell's Trench. Now, if you go to any siege site, it will have earthworks around it, you know, Cromwell's Well, Cromwell's Battery, Cromwell's Trench. Whether it dates to the later 1645 siege or not, you know, we can't really tell. Okay, so it's a catch-all name, you know, to get locals interested. But it's a big old ditch. It's aligned along a westerly alignment, and it's sort of a roughly rectilinear area. And it possibly is also surrounded by another ditch around it, bordered by marshy ground, and there's a slight rise. It may well have acted as a rampier, an artillery ramp, okay, for gunners to lob shells over the lob cannonballs over the walls as well. Now, as well as that, in the area to the southwest of the house during the 19th century, antiquarians digging in the farmland, they did also uncover a mass grave or at least six skeletons. One of them had a bullet hole for the skull, and this is possibly a grave for garrison casualties killed during the first siege. Obviously, it's outside the main stratum of the house. You don't want disease setting in amongst the garrison. That's about the worst thing that can happen. So you would site them outside, possibly after the fighting's finished, after May 1644 as well. And that's possibly also where the site of the house chapel is as well. In terms of, so that's the earthworks. There is also possibly a moated earthwork measuring about 23 meters square off to the west of the house as well. So there's a ton of earthworks around around the house. Certainly, it's a significant defensive landscape we've got situated around Lavram. The big problem with the archaeology at Lavram is that it has been done under a typical field archaeology remit. So it's been done as an understanding, as a research project, to understand the history of the house. It has not been undertaken under the same remit of a conflict archaeology study as well. And so although these earthworks have been identified, have they been tied in to a wider narrative of the siege of the house? I'm afraid that's not the case.
So do you know if anything's been done in terms of trying to sort of lay them as it perhaps would have been then with the earthworks and all of the defences?
Not that I'm aware of as of yet, and that's the big problem. It would certainly be the people that really need to be doing it. There's been two very, very good PhD studies of Civil War earthworks in the last couple of months by Richard Lees at Huddersfield University.
Oh, yeah.
And also Richard Israel, who's been doing all the fortifications along the Severn and the Welsh borders. They would be the people really that need to get onto it. And the problem is, I think they're coming across the same problems as I had in looking up what's going on in terms of the archaeology at Lavram. Either the data is not out there or it's in and amongst the grey literature, okay? And the problem with archaeology is lots of research work is done, okay, in terms of seeing what's down there, but then that stuff is left in an archive. It takes an archaeologist with a specific interest to pursue what this stuff means further.
You said that what was left was demolished and then put into a robotron.
That's correct. So one of the things you always want to be looking for when you're looking at defended manner. Looking at these rubber trenches, what you'll go down onto once you uncover it, you'll have tons of CBM, so building material, basically tons of brickwork. If you go down amongst it as well, you're going to have oxidized glass, window glass from it as well, maybe roof slates as well, maybe some timbers there. Right. But basically, the stuff is in such bad condition by that point, you know, it's not worth, you know, keeping it upright. So just tip the whole lot over into this trench, cover it over again, basically.
Yeah. So really, one, you know, I wonder if those houses from the period, and has anyone checked their fireplaces or staircases? Or...
Not that I'm aware of, but it would be my first port of call. Absolutely. You know, I think you'll find there's tons of stuff in the house. You know, the locals have gone, that's very, very nice. I've got delusions of grandeur for my nice townhouse. Let's rip it out and stick it in my living room, basically.
Imagine just sitting with your Christmas drinks around a Leatham House fireplace without realizing.
Oh, that's the thing. Going back to Basing, there's a tiny almshouse up the high street. Okay. You know, it's not a rich house at all, but I got invited once into their living room and there's enormous, you know, ornamental fireplace in there, you know, that's completely out of place. You know, it's a bit, someone in the 17th century, you know, has got their eye for chic, you know, and has stuck it in their living room. So,
yeah, that's it. No coat of arms on there or anything, you know.
No. I wish.
So is there a museum on site today?
I believe that there's the Leatham House Park Trust.
Right.
I'm not sure that there is a museum. I think any small finds that there are still held within the local archaeological authority. They need to be on display somewhere at least, I think.
Yeah.
There is enough small finds, you know, to be going with. The most recent big set of excavations they did there was back in 2009, and they found a ton of musket shot, quite a few of which were deformed. Now, a deformed musket shot, everyone, you know, time immemorial has always gone, well, that's hit something. They did some experimental shooting at Glasgow Uni about 5-6 years ago against ballistics jelly that's got exactly the same density as human flesh, and found if you fire a musket at it from about 200-yard range, the musket ball, okay, if it's hitting anything, okay, it's going straight for that ballistics jelly, it's not deforming. The only reason it should deform is if it's hitting a metal surface. So it's quite possible that the deformed bullets that we're having, they're spent bullets, okay, that have, you know, lost all impact and they've hit against a stone wall. That might explain them. It might be raw troops firing high, and that's why they've mushroomed out, basically. But it certainly doesn't represent, you know, people being killed by these projectiles.
Right.
So there's a ton of those being found. The problem is, again, they've been found unstratified, out of their archaeological context, within a spoil heap by metal detectors. And as soon as they're taken out that context, that's a big problem, because all the contextual information about where they've been found and what's been found around them as well is being immediately lost. That's a huge problem.
Sounds like it's such a complicated site then, to be honest, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially with there being absolutely nothing there at all.
What is interesting amongst those small finds as well, though, they were also finding big, big pieces of lead offcuts, you know, so we know where all that roofing material was going, you know. Parliamentarian soldiers after the fighting are taking offcuts of the lead to melt down later on as musket balls. As they've been marching off, they've been falling out their pockets as well. So, you know, it's a good image of, you know, what's happened, you know, to the rest of the material in that castle. Interesting enough, I mean, it shows you how heavily the castle was bombarded, because they found a ton of cannon shot there and a ton of mortar rounds that have been unfired. You can see it's a mortar round because it's round cannonball shape, but it's got a big hole through the top of it as well. And there've been at least 32 cannon shot found and at least 4 grenades. So it's a big amount of stuff that's been found.
Wow. So the hole go right through the shot? For the mortar?
Yes, it goes straight through it, so you can see it is definitely for a fuse that's been fitted to it.
Right. And I mean, because there was quite a huge mortar that was pulled up to the house, wasn't it? And I think they managed to, did they spike it or capture
they
it?
They did spike it, yeah, and sally out from the house. So they get it amongst the earthworks and they put it out of action. So, yeah.
Yeah, which was fairly, like quite a good feat of action on the royalist part there, wasn't it, non-Lady Dog?
Definitely. I mean, the fact is that if they are starting to bring up their mortars, they are now starting to breach walls. So you've got to get that mortar out of commission as quickly as possible, or it's curtains for you, definitely.
Mm. And she's outside of the wall at one point as well, isn't she? You know, not leading them, but encouraging the men to
absolutely. To I mean, definitely from the back. You know, she's not sword in hand, you know, going into the fighting, but she is definitely there, you know, egging them on for sure.
Yeah. Fascinating work, thank you. That, I mean, that's added such a good context to the siege itself, and just bringing it up to date and looking at what's there now or what isn't there now, we should say, and just where the archaeology is at. Last word on Latham. So, if you had to list the most famous sieges of the Civil Wars, does Latham make the top five?
I think it does. I think it does. If you look at any book, on sieges of the Civil War, you've got Basing, you've got Brampton Bryan, and Lavan will be amongst them. As I said, you know, that there's enough poetry written about the siege. I mean, Steve Eispan even, you know, has written a song about it, you know. So if it didn't have that reputation, it would not be remembered. And certainly, you know, the Marchioness, she certainly has a lot to pay for it as well. You know, if nothing else, you know, she is quite an inspiring figure, I think. Without Latham, most memory of her within popular perception would be forgotten. So certainly it plays a big part, you know, in her memoration, yes. Within public perception, definitely.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that has been really fascinating. Thank you, Warwick. Thanks for
sharing
your experience, your knowledge. So tell us about your books, Warwick. So you've got one due out, haven't you? So what's that one about?
So the one due out, I believe it's coming out in May. Still working on it at the moment, you know, so deep in the editing phase coming up. It's called Monmouth's First Rebellion, the later Covenanter Rebellions, 1660 to 1685. Obviously, the Covenanters, you know, play a huge part in the Civil War, but within popular perception, you know, Covenanters go away as soon as 1660 comes around, and that's certainly not the case. Although they believe after Charles II comes back, they believe, you know, the status quo is going to be kept. They're going to have the freedom to worship the way they had during the Civil War. That's definitely not the king's cause. And for the next 30 odd years, there is a period in Scotland, within southwest Scotland, known as the Killing Time times, where the king and the Scots government is basically trying to force out covenanting Presbyterian worship any way they can in favor of Episcopalianism. Now, the reason it's called Monmouth's First Rebellion is because, obviously, the covenanting movement, they get driven underground, they become militant, and there's a series of risings, first in 66 and then in 1679, in which they tried to take control within Scotland. The Duke of Monmouth is brought north to put them down at the Battle of Bothwell Brig June of 1679. And my argument is that what Monmouth later does at Sedgemoor in 1685 is directly influenced by what he's seen in Scotland.
Okay, fascinating. Oh, well, good luck, Warwick, with that. Keep us posted anyway, and you'll be back on the next episodes, no doubt. So, keep us posted on how it goes. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Watch out for the next instalment. If you'd like to know more about the Civil Wars, you can follow me on Twitter at 1642Author or visit my website www.1642author.com. And if you have the opportunity, please show your support for the show by rating Cavalier Cast on your podcast platform. Thanks for listening.